good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding.
You're listening to episode 595 of Unwelcome Guests, An Antidote to Forgetfulness. I'm Robin Upton. This week we're focusing on New Zealand. I've adapted for radio the 1996 documentary Someone Else's Country. I thought I'd begin with some comments by the researcher and director, Alistair Barry. This is what he wrote in November 2009. It's a quarter of a century since the New Right revolution began in New Zealand. New Right ideology has become known as neoliberalism, a new version of the old idea that economic liberalism, that says that society is best organized by free markets with as little government regulation as possible. New Zealand was one of the first countries to be taken over by neoliberalism. Since then, it has been forced on dozens of countries around the world. The result has invariably been a huge shift in wealth and power from the poor to the rich, and through globalization, to multinational corporations. By 2009, New Zealand ranked as the sixth most unequal society in the OECD, and first in the world at the rate at which inequality had grown over the previous 20 years. In poor countries, the cost of neoliberalism in human suffering has been staggering. The political process of achieving the neoliberal transformation has been extensively studied. It generally follows two stages. The first was rapid and radical changes imposed from the top by neoliberal politicians and bureaucrats, justified by a real or manufactured crisis. Controls over financial transactions were abolished, publicly owned corporations privatized, trade unions were weakened or destroyed by labour market deregulation, wages and welfare cut. The second phase was one of consolidation, led by massive tax cuts, limiting future government initiatives, and leading to further cuts in public services and the power of government. Over a period of time, people's expectations of their governments were expected to diminish as they adjusted to the new reality. It had been anticipated by New Zealand's New Right revolutionaries that by the early 2000s, our values would have changed and we would have come to think like them, accepting poverty and extreme wealth as both normal and necessary, to pursue personal advantage and to care less about our neighbours. But studies show that in fact our values haven't changed much from those of our parents and grandparents. What is happening, though, is that we are forgetting how things used to be and who changed them. Even as the human and environmental costs of the neoliberal experiment increase, we are finding it harder and harder to imagine how things could be better. I hope you will find this film a useful antidote to forgetfulness. Well, if he's talking about remembering how things used to be different, Alistair Barry is addressing an older audience. In my capacity as a teacher, I speak to youngsters and I need to let them know life didn't used to be like this. People didn't used to say these type of things. It used to be understood that there were many different reasons for doing things, and narrow financial self-interest was only one of them, not one that you got much respect for operating on if you did it all the time. Many of the youngsters that I speak to have a kind of poverty of experience, that they've been exposed to a sort of financial monoculture because they're used to commercially controlled media. They see something that looks like a sort of a consensus. Well, this is the only sensible way, this is how everybody behaves, and yet, because 99% of them are humans with consciences, their heart tells them that it shouldn't be this way. Is this perhaps related to why people are now occupying as a non-violent way to say to the 1% who are determined to promulgate their psychopathic value set as a means of using divide and conquer, we are not happy with this? I hope this film gives you pause for thought about the so-called financial crisis. Is this just another round of the manufactured crisis as an excuse for more austerity and sweeping changes. And now let's hear the film. Thank you to researcher and director Alistair Barry for this.
Create, create, create people's power. Create, create, create people's power.
In 1973, many New Zealanders watched with concern as Chile's new military dictatorship imposed wide-ranging social and economic changes.
General Gustavo Lee, member of the military junta, states, "We assure the entire world that we will open our doors to foreign capital."
All opposition was crushed as state-owned corporations were sold off. Multinationals took over most of the country's natural resources. Welfare and education spending was cut. Hospitals were privatized. 10 years later, no armed force was needed when a democratically elected government began a similar program of change in New Zealand.
Someone else's country. Vice President of Crown Zellerbach International.
I guess I have to go into what we do as we analyze investment opportunities. We go through the complete economic study of an opportunity. And the basic why, of course, is profitability. So we go overseas to help our profit, as I guess any company does as they look for investment opportunities in the U.S.
During the 1970s, the multinational share of world economic activity increased rapidly.
Senior Vice President Foremost McKeeson.
The investor gives you his money to use so long as you give him a return, which is greater than the original. That's it. So you have to grow. You can't stand still.
Chairman of Castle and Cook, owners of Dole and Standard Fruit Company.
Not just I, our whole management and our board would agree that we're in business to make money. We are not in business primarily to satisfy society if that requires us to lose money. Because if that's the way we go at it, we're not going to be able to satisfy society for very, very long because we're going to be broken out of business. So a profit has to be number one.
Profits and expansion were hindered in many parts of the world by laws regulating markets and protecting domestic business from foreign competition. In New Zealand, multinationals were frustrated by the protectionist policies that Labour and national governments had introduced over 40 years.
Robert Muldoon, Prime Minister and Minister of Finance, 1975-84.
We've kept the standard of living of our people level. Indeed, it increased somewhat. Certainly, we've had to borrow to do it. We've seen the level of unemployment go up, but not to the levels of the wealthier countries around the world who've had less impact from the recession than we have. Their unemployment rates, almost without exception, are higher than ours, and just look across the Tasman to see that.
But within the government's own treasury, a group of economists was reviewing economic strategy. Their head, Assistant Secretary Graham Scott, described them as a ginger group. They were to become the multinationals' greatest allies.
Jeff Bertram, Senior Lecturer in Economics, Victoria University.
The view that they were proposing was really that markets do know best, and that markets are places where private agents pursue private welfare, private benefit, private profit, with all the incentives that go with that. They saw markets as being enormously creative, enormously powerful allocative devices, but also better at making social judgments, better at shaping society than human agencies. And there was a real unwillingness to go back and revisit the origins of the welfare state in New Zealand, to think about why New Zealanders had come to do things the way they did. And because of the lack of historical understanding and the lack of historical depth in the work and thinking of these economists, their work really did come very directly from a single theoretical preconceived position.
The idea that markets know best coincided with right-wing economic theories popular in American universities at the time and practiced by the conservative Reagan and Thatcher administrations. It also fitted well with right-wing attitudes about increasing individual freedom and reducing elected authority. Altogether, these ideas became known as the ideology of the New Right. In New Zealand, the government's economists had a problem. Their minister, who was also the prime minister, didn't like their theories nor their advice.
You look at some of the taxes they're proposing. This is advice that I've rejected, of course. I make no apology for doing it.
That the workers that we represent...
In opposition, the New Zealand Labour Party didn't have a settled alternative economic policy. But one man in the party thought he could find the answer. In 1983, the Labour caucus elected David Longy as new leader.
I am not an economist, am proud to assert that I'm not an economist, and can use them insofar as they can be used, although I remember there's a chap called Stalin once that shot them. Now, I don't intend to emulate that, but I tell you that I am not going to worship at the altar of pretending to be an economist.
He selected his friend, Roger Douglas, to be Labour's finance spokesperson.
I think it's just the nature of the man, if you like. I think I'm reasonably active in whatever I undertake, and that tends to mean that I get involved.
In developing an economic policy for Labour, Roger Douglas was assisted by Doug Andrew, an economist seconded to the opposition research unit from Treasury. He and his colleagues found Roger Douglas more than ready to listen to their ideas.
The only way we're going to get out of this situation is to tackle all our problems and have good economic management.
But the problem for Roger Douglas was that these free market theories went against the traditional values of the Labour Party that he represented.
1984, presuming that is the next election, what's Labour's policy going to be?
Well, as I said, it will be along the same general lines as our policy in 78 and 81. First priority, full employment. Beyond that, we have to address ourselves to the need to make a reality of social justice. I think we've got the broad policies to do that. It's a question of refining the details and presenting them in a clearer way.
In June 1984, Prime Minister Rob Muldoon called a snap election.
Have we got a date, Prime Minister?
We got a date, the 14th of July, which we've worked out at Government House as being the appropriate date.
That doesn't give you much time to run up to an election, Prime Minister.
Doesn't give my opponents much time to run up to an election, does it?
The campaign was short but vigorous.
God bless you, David. I waited a long time for this.
Muldoon's dominating manner and heavy-handed control had eroded his popularity. Support had shrunk to a hard core of loyalists. While their minister travelled the campaign trail, the Treasury economists began writing a brief for the man they hoped would become their new boss, Roger Douglas. But this was no ordinary brief for an incoming minister. It was a comprehensive prescription for transforming the New Zealand economy. Corporate tax rates reduced to attract overseas investment, real wages cut, controls on foreign exchange transactions abolished, tariff and export incentives dropped. Where possible, government activities to be commercialized or sold. Welfare spending targeted and reduced.
And I give you specifically those pledges that you seek of our commitment to jobs, to see that there is housing and educational opportunity, but above all now, to see that there is a resurgence of the culture and the manner of the people.
The National Party continued to decline in the polls. The last of a number of official reports critical of Muldoon's handling of the economy was leaked 3 days before the election.
I know the New Zealand economy better than any other living soul. In or out of the state services, in or out of politics, parliament, anywhere else. I've lived with it intimately for 20 years. 20 years. And I know what we're doing. I know where we're going. That's where we're going. That's where we're going. And we're winning. And we're winning.
Behind me, we have a Prime Minister.
Jim Anderton, Labour Party President, 1979-84. Labour MP, 1984-89.
Theoretically, I should have been very pleased. I must admit to very mixed feelings on the night of the election, and I guess I must have had some sixth sense that things were going to happen that weren't going to be all good, but not in my wildest dreams on that election night did I believe they'd be as bad as they subsequently became.
The day after the election, Prime Minister-elect David Lange was informed of a major crisis. Over the last week, there'd been a massive run on the New Zealand dollar, and foreign exchange reserves had nearly run out. Chairman of the Reserve Bank, Spencer Russell, recommended a halt to foreign exchange transactions while the crisis was sorted out. Treasury and Reserve Bank officials flew to Auckland to meet Lange and his new inner cabinet. The officials recommended devaluation by 20%. It would cost taxpayers $750 million, but it would stop the run on the dollar.
When the Governor of the Reserve Bank tells me something, I listen. When the Secretary of the Treasury tells me something, I listen. When the business community and the real National Party tell me something, I listen.
Lange and the other senior MPs agreed to devalue. But, supported by officials, Roger Douglas proposed a package of further reforms, saying they were logically related to the devaluation. The package gave up government controls over many parts of the financial sector, leaving interest rates to be set by domestic and international finance markets.
Jim Anderton, Labour Party President, 1979-84.
I think there was a conspiracy between senior officials of the Reserve Bank and Treasury to work with elements of the Labour Party, Roger Douglas and others, to prepare a policy direction for government if the Labour Party was elected that they couldn't get past Muldoon. And it was virtually in the top drawer. And all those documents were already well prepared, if not written and printed practically. And as soon as Roger Douglas was elected, and the government was elected, and I think Roger Douglas's election was more important to the Treasury, really, in a sense, than the Labour Party. They had a Minister of Finance who was going to let them have the head.
The new Labour government's first caucus meeting was asked to endorse the devaluation.
Already perceived that we had this crisis, this financial crisis, and the atmosphere was a crisis, and we had to just do what the cabinet, the Prime Minister and Minister of Finance said, and we'd just been elected and we had to trust them, and they had this terrible crisis to fix and they couldn't really spend much time with us, but it'll be all right and we'll look after it and so on. That's when the alarm bells really started to ring, because I think I had a feeling I heard that kind of stuff before.
The exchange rate will be devalued by 20%. This will restore confidence in the currency, stop the speculation, and allow normal trading to proceed again.
I believe a very sensible decision has been taken. We'll certainly restore, I should think, New Zealand's reputation and credit rating around the world.
2 weeks later, the new government took office. Immediately, he began to implement his program of reforms.
Taken in isolation, the major effect of devaluation will be to increase prices. Taken in isolation, the major effect of lifting interest rate controls will be to increase interest rates. Taken in isolation, a major effect of the reduction in export incentives will be to reduce the profitability of exporters.
Taken together, however, these moves will improve the competitiveness of our products, help to increase employment, reduce the government deficit, and so help reduce inflation and reduce interest rates. And we are warning manufacturers that if they put up their prices excessively, that we will consider issuing further import licenses so that they face even more import competition from abroad. It is far better that we start adjusting to changes voluntarily than to have it forced upon us.
I believe that we can introduce into New Zealand competent economic management. And I believe that if we do introduce competent economic management, which is going to take a couple of years to show the benefits, then New Zealand can climb back to being one of the richest countries in the world and where everyone could expect an increase in their standard of living.
New Zealanders had got some idea of the extent of the reform agenda when Treasury's brief to their new minister was released some months after the election. The economy was still being described as in crisis.
30th of August 1984.
This government is asking the people of New Zealand for restraint and cooperation in this grave economic crisis. It would be unreasonable to ask for that commitment from the people of New Zealand without putting all the facts in front of them.
The Treasury and Reserve Bank advice had an ideological thrust that surprised university economists.
How would you describe the values, the philosophy, which is apparent in the Treasury from this document?
I wouldn't describe it as orthodox unless you regard extreme monetarism as orthodoxy. I think that, and I agree with Suzanne Snively, one of the great revelations of this report is the extent to which the Treasury has been penetrated, I think is the word, by monetarism.
Treasury, so far as we could see, had adopted a very simplistic approach to policy advice. They had taken, as if they were settled questions, matters on which we thought professional opinion differed. They had a position which we generally identified as monetarist, but not theoretically fully consistently monetarist. It was something of a theoretical mishmash, unified by a general faith in free markets.
But I think it's important that, say, the minister appreciates that there are monetarist views, but there are also neo-Keynesian views of how to manage an economy, and he's getting his advice from a particular perspective, right or wrong.
Over the next few months, economists with different views tried to debate the issues and the Treasury solutions to them, but they were outmaneuvered and outgunned.
Rufus Dawe, economist, Westpac Bank.
It doesn't matter how you measure it. It comes up with the fact, as the Minister said, we've been living beyond our means for 10 years. This has produced some horrible problems, which we have tried to solve by direct intervention in the economy, the command economy. It's failed, and now we are back trying something else. And hopefully we'll try a market economy.
Thank you very much.
It was generally recognised to be unwise to stick your head up and be too strongly critical of the government's position. Because to do so was to invite very serious counterattack, really. Institutions which tried to represent alternative points of view tended to find themselves under strong pressure. They tended not to be able to obtain funding, in many cases, government departments, for example. The institutions themselves were, in fact, abolished. So the academic economist very largely went back to academic discussion. The criticism of Rogernomics would be found alive and well in the common room. It would surface occasionally at papister conferences. But a sustained thread of public opposition to Rogernomics did not survive.
But also, Roger Douglas announced packages reducing government protection and support for whole sections of the economy in what he called quantum leaps.
Roger Douglas's line on all this was that you sort of had to do it to them before they did it to you. And the faster you did it, the less chance there was of opposition. So it wasn't a democratic process. It was a draconian process, almost totalitarian. You just rammed it through quickly because this medicine would never be swallowed voluntarily, so it had to be forced down. The faster the better.
Today's decision then to float the exchange rate is a logical progression from all these moves. It will increase the government's ability to manage the economy for the benefit of all New Zealanders. It will increase the strength and stability of policies keeping New Zealand on track for improved future growth.
The New Zealand dollar could now be bought and sold freely, its value no longer determined by government, but by international currency traders and speculators.
Very done, sorry, sir.
Borrowed money flowed into the country to fund more office space and new investment companies. Foreign banks set up shop.
Ollie Newland, property investor.
I couldn't believe what they were saying to me. They said, we're here to lend you money. Never forget that. We're here to lend you as much as you want. 2 million, 5 million, 10 million, and somebody chipped in, sky's the limit. Any amount you want. Well, I thought they were having me on at first, but they meant it. And it's very, it makes you very dizzy. Little guy sitting there being told that you can have as much as you want, just name it.
Bob Jones, property investor.
It is a bit of a giggle, and I think it's part of being a New Zealander and the inferiority complex that goes with being a citizen of a small country. And to go into Sydney and say, right, we're going to own this joint sort of thing, which we do now, actually, and we will pass the AMP, I believe, in about 3 months as the biggest property owner there. Next year's Manhattan, and we will go there and encounter a certain amount of scoffing. So it becomes a bit of a challenge to sort of knock them all over, which we will.
With many direct controls over the economy abolished, the productive sectors suffered. Jobs were lost, unemployment rose. Traditional Labour Party supporters, trade unionists and poorer working people were among the worst affected by what had become known as Rogernomics.
Jim Anderson.
The ordinary workers were telling the organisers what they thought of the Labour Party, but the union leaders were trying to preserve the Labour Party intact. Margaret Wilson, who'd taken over from me as president, was a buffer between the party and the unions and the government, and she took a lot of the flak for the government and absorbed it.
Margaret Wilson, Labour Party President, 1984 to 87.
Once you start a series of reforms, one is dependent upon the other. Now, I think the stage we've got to is setting in place the framework, and as I said, now we're in the process of actually implementing it. So that takes a bit longer.
Margaret's role was quite crucial, I think, to reducing the outrage and the expressions of it that would have come otherwise from a party if it had been led in the way in which I think the party could have and should have been led at that time.
But we do, I think, at times forget that the government has in fact made remarkable progress in a very short time. It is... Given then that the Labour Party has long preferred the mechanism of regulation and planning of the economy.
Alan Familton, Acting Head of the Forest Service, 1986-87.
The union opposition was just as muted as the Labour Party opposition was. The unions felt that Labour was in government, should be given a chance. There was quite an element of trust. So the unions played a positive role in support of the government, most of them, not all of them, and those of us who worked with them were put on the back foot, really, and told, in a sense, to shut up.
Through working together, we can ensure that the fourth Labour government will be one of the most significant in our history. Thank you.
The next item on Roger Douglas's reform agenda was publicly owned trading organisations. Our public assets and enterprises represented attractive investment opportunities for domestic and international corporations. But most New Zealanders weren't interested in selling.
With large and fast ships, we have spanned the oceans which separate us from our neighbors, and we have provided the best of port equipment for our commerce. We have spread a trackless land with a network of roads, and over them we operate the transport of a nation. We have bonded the country with rails of steel for our steam and electric trains. For the airports and aircraft, we have brought 20th century speed to a Stone Age land. We have harnessed the rivers to provide light and heat and power for our transport, our cities, and our industries.
One of our most valuable assets was the state forests.
The title of our department was Service. It's the only one amongst all the government agencies that had that title, and it tried to live up to that word service to the public.
If publicly owned organizations and assets were to be sold, they first needed to be reorganized into saleable items, to be restructured. Treasury officials developed an organizational model resembling, as closely as possible, a private corporation. Once government trading organizations had been reorganized to fit this model, they'd be ready for sale.
When the decision was announced in the cabinet room that the Forest Service and the Department of Lands and Survey were to go out of existence on the 1st of April 1987, that was the first intimation I had that that was likely to happen. Up until that point, we had been firmly led to believe by our minister and others involved in the restructuring process that it would be necessary to divide the responsibilities of the Forest Service and remove the commercial thrust from the servicing, support and non-trading range of activities of the department. All the work we had done and all the cabinet papers and ministerial reports we had prepared were based on that premise, not on how it would be best achieved to put the Forest Service out of existence.
For Treasury's plan to work, the new organisations had to be headed by businessmen who supported the new theories. For the Forestry Corporation, Roger Douglas himself effectively made the choice. His friend Alan Gibbs and John Fernyhough.
Alan Gibbs, businessman.
It's just so extraordinarily exciting because it's so new. I mean, what a wonderful opportunity to be involved right at the start of what is the most novel experiment in terms of converting government-run organisations into business organisations, which hasn't been tried anywhere else in the world.
Corporatisation has been a very necessary stage to get a handle on the enterprises, to get them roughly sorted out, and to get them directed in the right way.
Privately, Gibbs and Fernyhough favoured selling state assets. Publicly, Roger Douglas assured the public and his caucus colleagues that they would not be sold.
When you came to things like the corporatisation of state services, he ran the agenda on the lines that privatisation was no part of this agenda. All we wanted to do was make our government departments efficient and deliver services properly. Roger Douglas even told the caucus that once we had them running efficiently, we'd make so much money out of them that we could actually remove taxation altogether.
Corporatisation produced massive redundancies. Thousands of New Zealanders lost their jobs.
What about our families?
Rogernomics was hitting most sectors. Farmers and provincial towns were badly affected.
When you're in a small concern like ours, they're not workers, they become friends, and you don't kick your friends in the guts, sort of thing. But we had no choice. The downturn was so quick and severe that we had to do something to survive.
Spencer Russell, Governor of the Reserve Bank.
What I was saying was that I thought it would be a pity if, in the situation of the present downturn, this led to increased pressures on government to try and provide relief to certain sectors.
if you're going to take a stand, shouldn't you become a politician?
No, no, because I haven't entered the political arena. I haven't told the government what they should do. I have merely expressed an opinion.
Which is support of government policies.
Indeed.
Have marched 18 kilometres from Porirua here to Parliament to hold this government accountable for its election promises. This government stood on a platform of employment, and yet since it took power, there have been nothing but broken promises.
You're not paying them award wages.
What I've got to tell you,
the
training that may not be available through the formal apprenticeship system.
We are doing something decent for unemployed. You should support any movement that stops benefit fraud.
Okay. But he has not received the unemployment benefit since then.
No, because he was offered a job another in Waitaia where he moved to, and he declined to take that job.
Yeah, because he was living at Mangamuka.
Across the road, Treasury and Reserve Bank officials were encouraging every possible expression of support for Roger Douglas and his reforms. If big business were more politically active, Cabinet's resolve would be strengthened. Economist Roger Kerr resigned his job at Treasury to become executive director of the low-profile Business Roundtable.
Alistair Morrison, political journalist, Wellington.
The ideology was developed by Treasury that didn't really traditionally carry out public debate. It was still keeping the facade of a traditional public service, even though it was much more active and was actually a political department by this time. But what Kerr's arrival at the round table did was it allowed the new right to have a public face.
Doug Myers, vice chairman of the Business Roundtable, New Zealand's richest man.
New Zealand has adopted a package of economic structural changes and reforms that increasingly means the rigid structures that we have got to work with within the labour movement are just totally inappropriate to today's end. In fact, are not serving not only business, but are not serving the interests of workers as well.
Ron Trotter, chairman of Fletcher Challenge.
Time will prove that if we're to get the growth in the economy and the benefit from some of the very good economic changes of the last 3 years, then the labour market will need to be restructured more along the lines that we have advocated, and that is likely to happen eventually.
Kerr was a driving force, and they were his speeches, they were his thoughts, and he was the one that put the ideology together in its New Zealand form.
Roundtable ideas made the headlines and helped Roger Douglas keep the momentum going. The finance ministers intended to apply the state-owned enterprise model to government trading organisations case by case. After the forests, they turned to the Ministry of Energy, with divisions covering oil and gas production, coal mining, and the electricity division, which had developed some $6 billion worth of publicly owned assets.
Kevin McCool, last head of the NZED.
And so here was a new government with new ideas on how the place should be reorganised, and it was our task to make it succeed. So really there wasn't any sort of resentment or feeling that, you know, that something was wrong because of changing our organisation. That really the question was this was now government policy once it's been approved, and our task was to get on with it.
Ministry of Energy officials reviewed their organisation and concluded the profit motive was no substitute for good planning and coordination.
I think the Ministry of Energy people who were doing their review persisted for a fairly long time, hoping that their ideas would prevail, but certainly the government's concept of the state-owned enterprise won out quite clearly.
Associate Finance Minister David Cagle wanted to go even faster. With other finance ministers, he decided to impose Treasury's model simultaneously on 9 government-owned organisations. He called it a preemptive strike.
David Thorpe of the Public Service Association.
The government did not have a mandate to do what it did. It made a deliberate decision to launch the project across the board and to implement it as quickly as possible, thereby limit the opportunity for resistance building up to it. And that was largely successful.
Another reform advocate, Reserve Bank Deputy Governor Rod Dean, was appointed head of the State Services Commission to push through changes in the public service. Business Roundtable Chairman Ron Trotter headed a small committee to recommend businessmen and women to run the state-owned enterprises. Control of the nation's resources was shifting from elected authorities to the big business elite. On the 31st of March 1987, while public servants protested outside, the Prime Minister announced the creation of 9 state corporations, including Telecom, the Post Office, Coal, Electricity and Land.
6 months on, the benefits of corporatisation will be assumed. They won't be celebrated, but the pains of the past will be put behind and people will be very positive about their future.
But in the rush to set up new state-owned corporations, the rights of Māori over rivers, land and other natural resources had been forgotten. The New Zealand Māori Council took the government to court.
Moana Jackson, Unga Kaikwaka Marama Inga Ture.
Like all ideologues, the treasury, which was the driving force behind the assets policy, had not considered the wider human and social ramifications of that policy, and they had certainly not considered at all that Māori might use the treaty, or more broadly the rights of rangatiratanga, which predate the treaty, to oppose those policies. So if it was a moment of crisis for the Crown, it was a crisis not in terms of their assumed constitutional authority, but certainly a moment of crisis in terms of what they believed would be comparatively smooth sailing in implementing their policies.
A task force was set up inside Treasury to find ways of getting round the delays caused by Māori opposition under the Treaty of Waitangi. Under new management, the state-owned enterprise's profits rose rapidly.
How are you today?
Tens of thousands of people were made redundant.
We lost your 4 minutes.
Every prior knowledge I'd had of government would lead one to the view that it would be unlikely that politicians would ever let businessmen have a straight go at sorting out a commercial enterprise. I thought it was likely we'd be asked to compromise. We'd be asked to consider the political implications and so on. In fact, that hasn't occurred at any point.
After 3 years in power, the Labour Party was losing its traditional voters. But a worldwide boom in share prices and easy credit combined to send the New Zealand share market to dizzy heights. The middle classes felt they were getting richer, thanks to Roger Douglas.
Ray Smith of Goldcorp.
He's very honest. He's not intimidated by what people think. He believes that he has the answers. He's pursuing those policies, and I think he's got the strength to take them through.
Pop down a bit closer to Mr. Longy's face.
David Longy began the 1987 election campaign full of confidence. The opposition National Party had a new leader.
Jim Bolger.
Let us throw out the divisive policies of David Longy. Let us throw out the failed economic theories of Roger Douglas.
And this government has made its pledge. We addressed the economy in 84-87 and we addressed it big. And in 87 on, we are going right into that whole area of social policy, the duty of the state, in the areas of health and education, to be the dominant funders, the dominant providers.
Labour's promises were short on detail, but the direction was clear. Big improvements in public health and education. Meanwhile, Treasury officials were writing a brief for their Minister of Finance. But the brief didn't suggest ways for Labour to put its promises into effect. It did the opposite, proposing a new right prescription to cut government's role in health welfare and education. Labour's election campaign was well supported by big business and the multinationals. Of the $3.5 million Labour spent on its election campaign, thousands came from the unions, hundreds from party members, and millions from the corporate elite. A new investment company, Equity Corp, contributed $250,000.
Alan Hawkins, Equity Corp.
It's not so much a political donation to a political party. It was really against the background of the program and the environment in which we were able to work.
Do you think you would have given that donation had Roger Douglas not been at the helm of economic policy?
Oh, I don't think it would have been anything like that. I'm sure it wouldn't have been. You know, he was a key player, obviously.
Can I say to you that I find it enormously fulfilling that for the first time since 1938, the Labour movement has been re-elected to a second term in New Zealand Parliament. Can I thank you?
The Prime Minister announced his new cabinet a short time ago, and the allocation of jobs confirms that the Labour government will be pushing social policy.
I will be the Prime Minister and Minister of Education.
The new minister received the usual post-election briefing papers from the Department of Education.
There will be readjustments in priorities within education, and I believe there will be readjustments in overall government expenditure, adverse to some interests and favourable to education.
But he also received Treasury's briefing papers. Volume 2 carried their proposals to reform the education system.
Although they used all the rhetoric that would appeal to David Longley, it was nevertheless there for anybody who looked that what they were really concerned about was, first of all, a purely pragmatic concern that education was a very, very greedy user of public resources, and that they wanted that cut back, pragmatic, and that also that there was a strong ideological desire to move towards the privatisation of education for purely ideological reasons. So those two factors were very, very obvious. They weren't hidden, really, to anybody who gave more than a second glance to the document. But on the other hand, it was all dressed up in terms of the education system has failed, it's failed Maori, it's failed women, it's failed almost everybody, and therefore, if the Labour government wants to achieve its great ideals for education, then this is the way to go. So it was a very clever document. It has attached new right ideals and policies to old right desires to constrain education spending, to traditional left ideals about education as a liberating and democratising force.
Uncomfortable with Treasury's recommendations, David Longley went off to talk to the people working in education.
He didn't make any promises, but he was interested enough to make notes of the different queries that we had.
And a bit of disaster struck the bus.
The new minister was also waiting for a report from the PICO committee, set up to review education before the election. 9 weeks after the election, the New York stock market crashed. The next day, the New Zealand share market collapsed disastrously.
Self-chase $4. Self-chase $4. Come on!
What?
Small shareholders' savings disappeared in the fall, the worst in the world. The big new property investment companies were the first to go under. Their huge loans in the deregulated finance market turned out to have been made against virtually worthless assets. The economy went into recession, but that didn't stop the progress of the new right agenda.
I believe that the events of the last 3 weeks mean that we need to accelerate the process of reform rather than stop it.
On the 17th of December 1987, 8 weeks after the crash, the government announced further radical changes.
The commitments we make today, the signals we send to all sectors of our economy, will shape this country's economic development for the rest of this century.
The main aim was to attract international investors. Tariffs were halved, company tax was cut to below that of Australia.
It's important that our company tax rates are competitive with those of our trading partners to ensure that we get investment in New Zealand and thereby jobs. It's also important that our personal tax rates remain competitive with our trading partners so we retain skilled people.
High income earners and investors would have massive tax cuts. But the most significant announcement was the government's sale of 13 state-owned enterprises.
It is more important that we pay off the debt than that we keep the assets.
It's a very bold, dramatic package which is going to put New Zealand right in to the forefront of international countries.
Domestic and foreign investors welcomed the government's announcements. David Longhi spent his 1987 Christmas break at the beach, pondering the way that his government was moving more and more to the right. Back from holiday, he bypassed his cabinet colleagues and went on television to reject the December income tax cuts as unfair to the low paid.
Faced with the choice of relentlessly pursuing things which might be inequitable in application to save one's political face, on the 1st of October 1988 is not something that I'm prepared to do, nor is Roger.
Roger Douglas couldn't speak for himself. He was overseas. But David Longhi's about-face was great news to the opposition.
Well, it's clear that the Prime Minister's statement today is a massive vote of no confidence in Roger Douglas. It was he who prevailed to make the announcement on December the 17th.
In December we had a very positive statement. We had a cart with all four wheels and a packet of goodies in it, and now the wheels seem to have fallen off.
Once Roger Douglas was back in the country, Cabinet agreed to modify the flat tax proposal, but most of the package remained. The asset sales would proceed regardless of public opinion. The national airline would be sold to a consortium, including its competitors, Japan and Qantas Airlines. Also on the block were the Maui platform and natural gas reserves and distribution network, the petrochemical fertilizer and methanol plants, the public share of the oil refinery and oil reserves and the Motunui natural gas to synthetic petrol plant, which meets 30% of our petrol needs. All would be sold to the New Zealand-based multinational Fletcher Challenge. Over half of New Zealand's banking and insurance sector was publicly owned. All these companies would be sold to their Australian and British competitors and Fay Richwhite and Fletcher Challenge. The New Zealand shipping line, established by the third Labour government, would be sold to its European competitor, Associated Container Transport. New Zealand steel and the country's iron sand resources ended up in the hands of its giant Australian competitor, BHP. There were few constraints on other foreign investors.
David Cagill, Cabinet Minister.
We like to know what's happening, so we run an approval system, but we seldom turn people down. And these days especially, we're keen that people should come in from overseas and set up here. So anything that can be done from the government's point of view will be done to encourage that.
At first, the intention was to sell the forestry corporation as a going concern, but deciding how much the forests were worth was taking too long for Roger Douglas. He was also under pressure from the big timber companies, who didn't want to compete with the new corporation. So he decided the quick way to determine the value of the forests and satisfy the timber companies was to simply sell the forests off in blocks to the highest bidder.
Alan Familton, acting head of the Forest Service, 1986 to 87.
To me, it seemed a remarkable thing to do. These forests, don't forget, were owned by the taxpayers of this country. It's their money that established them over the last 30, 40 years. And to turn round and sell, often at fire sale prices, the results of all that investment, all that expenditure, all that dedication from staff and workmen to companies from overseas, to the Japanese, to Malaysians, to whoever came in with a reasonable bid, to me just seemed appalling.
A public opinion survey showed that 79% unequivocally opposed selling state forests, only 4% unequivocally favoured selling them.
It certainly wasn't a popular action, as far as I can judge. Nobody I've spoken to has thought it's a good idea to have done this. Particularly when you think, the way I bitterly, I suppose, sum it up is that it's taken politicians 3 years to get rid of what it took a pretty good government department 66 years to build up.
In May 1988, PICO's Education Review Committee reported to the Minister of Education, David Longy.
Bad system, good people. Good people. As our consultant said, the system was in fact carried along on the backs of the dedication and the professional integrity of the people working in it.
Phil Kappa, Post-Primary Teachers Association.
Oh yes, we get frustrated by the old Department of Education. Oh yes, we get frustrated by education boards, but that's not what it's really about. But of course, as far as the Treasury were concerned, that's what it really was about, because until you could get through these structures, these administrative structures, you could not begin to bring market disciplines to education. And to that extent, their goals are clear in here. They were heading towards the dismemberment or dismantling of central bureaucracies. They were heading towards schools as competitive units. They were heading towards schools as acting under very, very tight financial discipline so that funding could be capped, and preferably perhaps towards privatisation.
It is not an abdication of assurance of controls and quality. It is a major democratisation at the level of the board, particularly for primary schools and for secondary schools, an enhancement of their role.
A campaign of public consultation began.
The idea, of course, about the whole PICO thing is to make sure that you as teachers have access to ready decision making. When you're on a board of trustees...
Schools and the public were invited to make submissions about the PICO report.
Democracy and its authority, and the two have to work together.
The invitation was well received. Submissions poured in.
John Russell, principal of Mana College, Porirua.
We were concerned about staffing levels, the ability of schools in richer communities to shift resources into staff funding, and therefore we could see at that point the whole gap between the rich and poor being blown apart and just being expanded through. So we tried to focus on those issues.
There were 12,000 submissions which the government considered and duly ignored, because in 1988 along came the white paper, August 1988, Tomorrow's Schools.
The form which the government is announcing today will be amongst the most important the government will ever implement.
Clearly there are a number of agendas in the pot. There's the Treasury agenda, which is a matter of shifting responsibility, in essence, or the government's agenda, shifting responsibility as much as possible for outcomes.